Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. And for over two decades, Will Hurd has served our nation as a former member of Congress, a cybersecurity executive, and an undercover officer in the CIA. He's carried that experience into three terms in Congress, where Will served for a time as the House's only Black Republican, representing a 71% Latino district from the great state of Texas. And as a cybersecurity executive, Will has worked with entrepreneurs across the country on the cutting edge of technology to anticipate the shock waves of the future, some of which we're starting to feel already. He's gotten big things done in America, and he's not done quite yet, as Will is out with a new book, American Reboot, An Idealist's Guide to Getting Big Things Done. We're going to talk about those big things and a whole lot more coming up on the Michael Steele Podcast. So everybody, like I said, I'm really excited about my buddy Will Hurd joining us for a great conversation. Hey, Will, what's up, baby boy? How you been? What you doing? Got to hang out last weekend at the South by Southwest.
That's right. That's right. When, you know, we were kept getting interrupted because all your adoring fans kept coming over and saying hello. That was
dude,
fun.
I just owed those people money. That's all. That's what that was. It was great.
And so no, man, look, it's been fun. It's wild to think I've been out of Congress now for a little bit over a year, and I've, you know, got this book coming out, been working with some great technology companies, you know, the seeing how crazy the world is. Right. There's so many things going on.
Well, so before we get into the book, which I'm excited to talk about, because there are a number of aspects of the book that I think are really important to get into. Just update us on what you're doing. So you did the Congress thing. What told you it was time to leave? At what moment did you realize, go, you know what, this shit just ain't gonna work the way I want it to work?
Sure. You know, it's funny. So in 2009, when I ran the first time, I said then at the time, and I was unsuccessful. I don't have to tell that story anymore, right? I made it to a runoff, lost a runoff by 700 votes, which is not a lot of votes, as you right. know. But even during that process, I said that doing these jobs well, you have a shelf life. Right. And I thought it was always 6, 7, or 8 years, right? It was fascinating. People always got mad at me because I said I wasn't for term limits because, look, if you want to get somebody out, go vote them out, right? And a lot of times you can do that in primaries. Not that many people vote in primaries. And then those are the same people that are like, I can't believe you're leaving.
Right.
For me, I think it was opportunity. There was other opportunities. I love talking technology in a policy setting. Now I'm talking policy in a technology setting. I think we're dealing with, look, one of the topics I've been talking about for a long time and I get into in the book as well is, we're in a new Cold War with the Chinese government, and it's good. And the battlefield is over advanced technology. Right. And the only way America is going to win is if the public and the private sector are working together. So being able to work on these issues now, like I'm on the board of a company called OpenAI. They are developing artificial general intelligence, meaning you're going to have an algorithm that is better at a thing than most humans. Mm-hmm. It's why this isn't science fiction anymore. This is science reality, right? Coders are using this now in order to develop code. It's like 30% of the code that's on GitHub is developed using this tool. We can program DNA the way we program computer code now. There's a biotechnology company we're helping with. I don't know if you've ever eaten an Impossible Burger, right? Burger tastes like meat because some scientists figured out it's hemoglobin that makes meat taste like meat. And so they took the hemoglobin and injected it into a yeast molecule and made the yeast molecule bleed. You're like, what the heck, right? So for me, the opportunity to use all those things I've learned, when I was in the CIA, when I was in the cybersecurity company, when I was in Congress, to work on this cutting edge. So that's been great. And I work at a company called Allen & Company. I'm a managing director, where I'm advising all kinds of technology companies that have a national security application. So it's been a lot of fun.
So the brother's been busy. That's what you're saying. The brother's been busy. Yeah. He's making bank. He's sort of creating that nexus between his CIA world, his congressional world, and his business world, which is all good. Now, I get the, hemoglobin into yeast, but, cut the cow up, grind that meat down, baby, and serve that burger.
Right,
you don't have a Texas burger without the cow.
I get it. I'm with you. I'm with you. I like old fashioned. I like it old fashioned.
I get the point though, where you're saying about the technology, and I do want to get into that because you get into that in the book. And the book, folks, is America Reboot. An idealist. I love this. You're just straight up. I'm an idealist. Let me tell you, I got a guide here to getting big things done. How do you see, just top line at this point, the landscape, now that you're out of Congress for a little bit, you're immersed in the world in a way that you weren't as a member. And that, I think that's an important distinction to make, because a lot of folks think that a lot of those experiences sort of inform congressional thinking. That's not necessarily the case, because it's insular and there's just a lot of stuff that's bombarding you 24/7. But now you get to see the world through a different lens and can relate it back to your experience on the Intelligence Committee or working in the economic space. How do you see the landscape right now as you were sitting down to write about this guide to getting things done?
Look, the landscape, in my opinion, is that there is a question about whether the rest of this century is going to stay the American century. Mm-hmm. And I want it to, by the way, right? I think we have a number of challenges that we have to address. And one of the problems getting in the way is a crazy political system, right? Our political gears have gotten mucked up and is preventing us from doing the things we need to do in order to make sure this century stays the American century. And look, people feel that. The number of folks across the country that feel like the country is on the wrong track, right? That number is north of 70. You're seeing similar kinds of polling in other countries. I'm also on the board of the German Marshall Fund. We are the torchbearers of the old Marshall Plan, right?
Right.
And we have offices in Europe, and it's about the transatlantic relationship. Some of these same trends that we're seeing here in America, you're seeing those in Europe as well too. And so this is where we're at. Like, I want to make sure that we're proudly going into the future, right? Not stumbling into it. And so that's the concern. And I've been able to see some of these challenges up close, whether it was in Congress and business or in national security space. Oh, and guess what? It's a complicated, dangerous world. We're seeing that right now. Would we have been in the situation that the world is in right now with Vladimir Putin if we would have responded to it a little bit differently in 2008 when he invaded Georgia, or in 2014 right, when he went into Ukraine in the first place? And those concerns, right? And people are questioning all of our beliefs about Russia, about Europe. And these were all beliefs that we were formulated back in the 80s, right? And so people are starting to think, wait a minute, if Russia's doing this now, what is the Chinese Communist Party going to be doing in 20 years and or in 10 years, in 5 years? And what should we be doing now to prepare for that kind of global competition? And the other thing I'm seeing now, technology is moving faster than what I saw and knew when I was in Congress, but also our adversaries are further along than we ever knew. And so if anybody doesn't think China is a peer, then they're completely wrong. So this is where we're at, but I'm also seeing on a political side, Michael, and way more unites us as a country than divides us.
Right.
Twitter is not reflective of
most society. Why do you think people stop believing that? Because as you're saying, Twitter sort of is a reflection of the instant gratification of screaming at someone or condemning them or praising them. So it's that instant gratification mm-hmm. response. Why do we not believe that we are greater together, we are stronger and better together, that there's more that unites us than divides us?
So I think people do believe that. People want, and here's how I know.
But they're not acting like that.
Well they're not acting like that on social media.
45% of Americans think that what happened on January 6th was okay. So they clearly...
You have people feeding them that, right? Like I think that is the problem. The way I got elected when I was in Congress, right? You know the old district, 29 counties, two time zones, 820 miles of the border. It flipped back and forth, RD for a decade. I was the first one to hold it multiple cycles, held it for three cycles. And what was always fascinating, everybody saw my district as a bellwether of what's happening in the rest of the country. And so I would have national reporters come down. And I held more town halls than anybody. I used to do these DC to DQ trips where I would do 35 town halls in 5 days at Dairy Queens, right? And I would tell the reporters, look, I'm gonna do my thing. I'll leave the last 15 minutes to ask you a question. And the reporters were always shocked the questions I got mm-hmm. because they were not the questions that were being debated on social media, that was being debated on cable news. It was stuff like, why are my roads so crappy? I'm a veteran. Why does it take you so long to get into to see the VA? Or why is my kid's school not prepared to not have a computer science program because we think that's a skill they need in the future? These were the questions that people were asking, right? And why does in social media, why do things get more clicks when you're crazy or you yell or you do those things? I don't know. Is that reflective of our own internal behavior? But I deeply believe, and I've seen that when I was in Congress, I see that now, that there's the opportunity is to do things different. The opportunity, right, is to actually inspire those people, because when it comes down to it, most decisions politically get done in a primary, and not that many people are voting in primaries. There's right. way more people that vote in general elections and not in primaries. And I think that is the opportunity. Is it happening right now? No, but I actually think that's the opportunity and where we should be going to.
So let's get into the reboot, the book itself. It's coming out soon, correct?
The 29th of March.
29th of March. All right. So just peg that date, folks, because you want to get this book. I have an advanced copy, so I have a chance to read in preparation for this wonderful conversation. But it's a very good book. It's a real book in the sense that I can actually hear you talking to me in the book, which is important. It's an important element of a good writing when you can hear, you feel the author is like, hey, let's sit down and have a conversation. Like sitting in this wonderful fake library and just buy all the books and having it read to you. So let's get into it. It's American Reboot, an idealist guide to getting big things done. And in it, and I want to flip right to the first part of it, which I love, because the story you tell really kind of sets up the book. And it was in the introduction where you talk about getting off the X. Mm-hmm. Because that's when you, I don't know if you intended it that way, but that was how I kind of read through the book, was at various times you were showing us how to get off the X, get off the thing. So first off, tell that story about getting off the X, but then help us relate it to the rest of the narrative in the book, where it becomes very obvious, for example, that we need to do that in our politics.
Right. So get off the X, something we learn. It literally is the second lesson you learn at the farm when you're learning to be a CIA undercover officer, right? And the notion is, the X is where something's going down.
Right.
And the last place you want to be where something's going down is where it's going down. So go. Get away, right?
Get
out of there, right? That's what we learned. And so that's this concept of always get off the X, right? And I tell this story at a time in when I was in South Asia, and I basically run over a woman's flip-flop. I'm in a little car, I create chaos. There's hundreds of people banging on my car, shaking my car. And, you know, I was trying to get off the X, but my car, my little Toyota Tercel wasn't going to be able to get me that far, right? And I had a weapon, but not enough ammunition for this situation. So I got out of the car, right? And then I helped the lady and got her to a hospital. And the crowd started clapping. They're patting me on the back, right? It was an instance where I literally thought my mom was going to get a phone call no mother ever wants to get, right? But the situation de-escalated so quick because of a show of compassion and empathy. And so this notion is, we got to get away from where the things are going down. We got to get away from this politics that's so corrosive and that focuses on the edges rather than the middle. We got to get away from a foreign policy that is not based on having our friends love us and our enemies fear us, right? Like, we got to be ready to take advantage of technology before it takes advantage of us, right? And so this notion is, yes, we got to accept where we are right now, but we got to get away from it because we want to make sure that we're ready. So that was kind of concept. And I try to tell some stories from my time when I was in the CIA, when I was in Congress, and how I use those principles and things I learned in all those experiences to apply them to whatever I'm doing at the moment or what we need to do now to make sure this century stays the American century.
So one of the ways you right out of the gate in the first part of the book talk about our party. You've not left the Republican Party, I tell you. You're still a Republican like myself.
That's right.
So this is our fight for good reasons. And you immediately get into one of the things, and again, this how I carry forward this analogy about getting off the X, reading that in the introduction and then going right into the first part of the book where you talk about the GOP needs to look more like America. And it's something I've been saying for 30 years in and beyond in my service to the party, is that is an X we have to get off of, that America looks, that America still looks a lot like Southern white men or, you know, white suburban women, or just to break it down, just white folks. That one of the strengths of our opportunity rests in this idea that from our beginning, we have always been about the totality of America, everybody's liberties, everyone's freedom, everyone's opportunity. How do you see that playing out right now? And what are some of the things that we should do to get off that X?
So I agree with everything you said. And it's actually an opportunity for the GOP. And more than just Republicans should care about this, right? A Democrat should care, independents should care, people that don't vote should care, because having two strong parties is essential to our democracy. It's essential to having a competition of ideas so that we do are prepared to tackle these generational defining challenges that we're dealing with. But imagine this, right? So we're seeing Republicans are going to take the House back in 2022, period, full stop. Mm-hmm. We're going to do that in a lot of ways because of improvements in minority communities, especially Latino communities. The district I represented was a 71% Latino district, and everybody thought it was crazy that a Black Republican represented it, right? And we're going to see in Texas, potentially 3 of the 5 border congressmen being Republicans. I used to be the only one. My replacement is the only one right now. Could possibly see 3. Why? Because Democrats' ideas are so bad.
Right.
You know, they
totally misread the electorate. That's for sure.
It's totally bad, right? It's totally bad. When you look at the border security is a public safety issue to people on the border. Mm-hmm. The crisis is the worst it's ever been, right? 2, 40% of Latinos along the border are involved or have a family member involved in law enforcement. This nonsense about defunding the police, that impacts their livelihood. And then the reason America is energy independent is because of the Eagle Ford Shale and the Permian Basin in South and West Texas. Again, about 40% of Latinos involved in the energy sector, right? So the Democrats' ideas were so bad. That is why you're seeing a shift. Imagine if these folks also said their ideas are bad and we like these other guys.
Right.
The danger in 2022 is Republicans, when we win, are going to take that as the country loves us. No, the country thinks the other people are incompetent, right?
Right.
It's a big difference. So imagine that instead of having the best ideas, people didn't see us as misogynists. People didn't see us as racist. People didn't see us as homophobes. That is the way that we could increase and start winning and have a lock on electoral politics for a very long time. That's the upside. Oh, and by the way, the Democratic Party has ignored and taken for granted the minority communities for a very long time. Guess what folks in Atlanta care about? Folks in Atlanta care about making sure there's an opportunity for them to start new jobs, right? And start new businesses and hire good people. So look, education, when you look at education, choice, you know, educational choice in Texas, has done a longitudinal study of about 20 years that school choice has reduced the achievement gap between Black and brown kids and white kids in Texas. Nobody talks about that, right? It's a huge impact. And we have income inequality because we have education inequality, and we have the better ideas on this. So when we have nuts in our party, that look, every time I was running, I always had to answer for every crazy thing a Republican did across
the country. We always do.
Right? You know what I'm saying? You know this. I'm preaching to the choir. So part of this is also the way we get out of this, show up. Go to communities that have never seen a Republican before. Because guess what? If they haven't seen a Republican before, I bet you they've never seen an elected official. And we have an opportunity to take a message to communities. And look, we're probably going to have several Latino Republicans elected this cycle. We're going to have, right now, I have 3 Black Republicans in the House. There's going to be at least a 4th with Wesley Hunt out of Houston. There's an opportunity for us to take advantage of.
So let's focus on, because we're both Black Republicans, and we have to count on 2 fronts. We have to count on the Republican front. We have to count on the Black front.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily as a brand Black Republican have standing in our own community to have those conversations. So it's great to elect a Will Hunt, but who's electing him? It ain't Black folks.
Sure.
Right? And I've always said that we don't turn that corner until we elect a Black Republican from Harlem. We elect a Black Republican from Baltimore, because then you're going to be talking about someone who has a nexus into the community that will further engage that community to a broader perspective of what Republicanism is and what it isn't. So when you look at a state like Texas, what are those Black Republicans saying to the broader electorate, white folks, and specifically to the Black community when they watch the legislature impose draconian election laws, not across the state, but on the four majority black and brown counties that they want to investigate for voter fraud. Well, we know there was no voter fraud in Texas. Donald Trump won the state of Texas. So what the hell are we investigating?
And Republicans were in control of the votes.
And Republicans were in control of the vote. So you're saying Republicans were corrupt? Because that's you ran the vote in the state of Texas. So that's when black and brown people say that, yeah, they may on the border vote for the Republican because they think the Democratic policies are crazy. But that is not enough to build a movement around. And it's not enough to claim success in the future, because if and when the Democrats get their act together on policy, right? Mm-hmm. You're still out here talking and doing crazy shit. What do you think is going to happen?
We're not going to increase our numbers within the black and brown communities, right? So I agree with you. That is why we should be for increasing the number of people that can vote, making it easier, making anyone to be able to. If Estonia can vote online and on their phone, why can't we do it, right? The more people to vote, the better off it is, right? And if you're appealing to more people, then you don't have to try to keep them at home when it comes time to vote, right? So I agree with you. And those are some of the issues that are preventing us from taking advantage of this opportunity, right? And so you're right. We can't be seen. That's why I go back to one of the chapter's titles is, pardon my language, don't be an asshole, don't be a racist, don't be a misogynist, don't be a homophobe, right? And so when we do these things, and by the way, like, look, everybody thinks that voter ID is okay, right? Nobody's disagreeing about those kinds of things. But yes, if one county wants to vote at midnight, let them vote at midnight, right? And then also the other opportunity and what we need to do in order to improve our chances is to be ideologically consistent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you believe in local control, that means you got to give people local control. And if that local control is not what you like, you can't take it away.
Right.
And so, Michael, you know this better than anyone. And these are some of the hurdles, even though there's some opportunities and we're seeing a growth. I think Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago talked about how it was amongst minority communities, and you're seeing an increase voting for Republican candidates. And I want to say it got into the low 30s. Well, you're never going to get beyond that if we don't address some of these other things like that is causing the broader party to be perceived as anti-black, anti-gay, and things like that.
So one of the things that I think feeds into what you just said, and you have a whole section of the book that talks about leadership and defines fairly clearly what leadership should be, what it is, how it functions, how it achieves the ends of the community. It's, you know, I loved one chapter. I think it was have the audio match the video, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So that goes to that idea you were just saying about consistency, being consistent and having that authenticity to you. What is it about the failure of Republican leadership right now? So I don't want to lead the witness, as we would say. What is it about Republican leadership right now that may or may not meet the various tests that you set forth in your book?
It starts with what are our values, right? And do our actions reflect our values? And if you say your values are for freedom, and freedom leads to growth, growth leads to opportunity, or excuse me, freedom leads to opportunity, opportunity leads to growth, and growth leads to progress, then you can't go back on, you know, what you thought happened on January 6th, right? When people mm-hmm. were coming in armed political violence, right? Mm-hmm. To stop a democratic process from happening. You can't say that decisions should be made at a very local level and then tell those local people what they can or cannot do. You can't in one breath say we shouldn't be in places like Afghanistan and then criticize the other side for doing too much when it comes to Ukraine, right? And so we should be a party that's based on our values, right? We should also appreciate diversity of thought within our own team, right? We shouldn't be part of groupthink. We criticize, you know, a moderate Democrats for falling in line with far left progressive liberals, but you know, we want to drown people out that have a different of opinion. And so the thing that I've learned, a lot of our elected officials have never had, prior to being in office, have never had to make tough decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Where doing the right thing actually had consequences.
Right.
When I talk to kids a lot, and I always tell them, being a person of character takes practice, just like being a musician or being an athlete or being a doctor or being an engineer. And the more you practice doing the right things, the easier it gets when the stakes are high. If you do the right thing when the stakes are low, you're going to be able to do the right things when the stakes are high. And unfortunately, there's too many elected officials that want to grasp and stay in office. They like wearing the pin. They like being called congressman. And so they start sacrificing their values to go after something. My dad's 89 years old. And when I was making the decision about what I was going to do next, he's like, William, you know, he sold beauty products, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, William, I don't know. I can't give you advice on these things that you're weighing. He's like, but I do know one thing. Don't be desperate. When you're desperate, you're clinging on something so hard,
right,
you're going to make bad decisions, right? And I think sometimes there's a desperation in trying to hold on these positions. And again, I know this is reflected because people were so shocked when I walked away. And they didn't understand it. But for me, it was, I don't equate my ability to have an action and impact associated with my position or my career. Anyways.
No, that's right up my alley. In fact, while attending South by Southwest, I was down there to talk about voting, and someone had come up to me and was, you know, sort of, you know, are you getting back in the game? Why aren't you running for office? Because you can really make a difference. I said, I can make a difference where I am. I mean, the office is great. And yeah, it would be right now in many respects, to your very important point, to be in a position with representative, senator, congressman, you know, governor, whatever, leading your name and taking these very strong democratic positions, supporting our democracy over the party, supporting our country over a particular elected official or non-elected official, would send a signal of, yeah, I'm willing to sacrifice my position, a la Liz Cheney, for the greater good of the country, for the greater good of the party, actually, because that is a beacon, a clarion call to the party to follow the right path, to do the right thing. It would be easier, but that doesn't mean that you're less effective or not as effective in the role that you play outside of that, because you still have the credibility of being former Congressman Will Hurd. That still has power and weight to it. And when you speak, as you've spoken in this book, people will pay attention to that, and they will see a consistency, not just in the message, but in the character of the individual. And it's hard to get political players to see that today. A lot of them are looking through a very narrow, sort of fogged up lens, and are not necessarily recognizing this democratic moment that requires them to say and act and do things differently, because the country needs that done right now.
Miley, 100%. What's so funny is the older I get, the more basic my questions become, right? Like.
Oh, wait till you get to my age, baby. You're gonna be down to like 3-word questions. What the hell?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what is the role of America in the rest of the world, right? Sure. Like, that seems like something such a simple, easy question. And I remember when I was at my degree's in computer science. I thought I was going to go work for IBM and program computers. And I saw a sign that said, take 2 journalism classes in Mexico City for $425. I had $450 in my bank account. I go to Mexico. I loved it. Like, the things I learned, I saw things that blew me away. I was like, I'm going to add international studies as a minor. And the first class I took, the first lesson was on the rule of law. And yeah. I'm, 18-year-old Will Hurd is sitting there like, the rule of law? Like, of course it's law. This is the first lesson? How dumb is it? This is like so basic. But I didn't realize how big of a deal that was until I lived in places that didn't have rule of law. Like we take for granted, right? So think of this. I loved my time in the CIA. There was the historical tension between the CIA and the FBI. And I'm able to criticize and question what the FBI is doing on encryption and things like this. In most countries, that would not be allowed, right? Yeah. And so for us, we take for granted this notion that we assume democracy is a fait accompli, that it's going to always happen, that you don't have to work on it, that it's so hard. We call it the American experiment because it was really an experiment. There was no democracies in the world when America became a democracy. And one of the things I learned in the research of this book, the next democracy wasn't until 60 years later, and it was Switzerland. There are only 14 countries that have been a democracy for more than 100 years. This is still an experiment,
right?
And it's hard, and we have to work on it, and it requires people to make sure their values, right, make sure their audio and the video match, right? Do what you say you're going to do. And this is critical on both sides, because ultimately, if we are going to make sure the century stays the American century, that Americans are going to be able to continue to increase their quality of life, that we're going to be able to continue to uplift humanity, we have to have leaders that inspire rather than fearmonger, right? That's the opportunity. That's what we're going to need. And we're not seeing that for many people.
We're having a wonderful conversation with my buddy, Will Hurd, former congressman from the great state of Texas. He's out with a new book that will be hitting the bookshelves and Amazon on the 29th of March. 29th. It's American Reboot, An Idealist Guide to Getting Big Things Done. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a few of those big things that need to get done right after this.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Hi, this is Harry Littman, former United States Attorney, current LA Times legal affairs columnist, and creator and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day, from voting rights.
Voting in our country has a specific racial connotation and a racial history, and one in which it has been fundamentally about moving away from exclusion and at a snail's pace.
To the January 6th Select Committee.
We're going to see almost every actor who's culpable in this refuse the subpoena.
To U.S. national security and foreign relations.
I served in the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11, and I've seen what happens when there's boots on the ground.
To anything and everything at the Department of Justice.
The hardest thing about coming into the Department of Justice, it's not like everything hits reset. There are court proceedings and investigations that are all midstream, and you don't control when you get to make a decision on those.
To hear roundtable discussions with the country's most prominent voices from government, journalism, and law. Follow us wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody. We're drilling down with my man, Will Hurd. We're fresh off of our of our little jaunt to South by Southwest in his backyard in the great state of Texas in Austin, where actually by happenstance, I ran into Will. I was hanging out with a mutual buddy, and he was going over to meet at that, what that mutual buddy, by the way, was Congressman Peter Mayer. we're having some fun. Dude, in this book, you talk about the things that we need to do, and you lay out, again, we've touched on, X marks the spark, kind of, get off the X and then move accordingly, the kind of leadership that's required in order to do the things that need to be done. Let's get into some of the big things you think the country should be looking at right now. You're in the cyberspace. Clearly, there are some enormous challenges there for this country. We take a lot for granted in the cyberspace. Now, I mean, just the easy baseline one-off stuff is, okay, change your passcode from I love mom to something a little bit more complicated. Yeah. All right. So there's that level, but then there's bigger stuff as we've seen now narratives evolving in the war in Ukraine around what Russia will or will not do, how the various NATO alliance allied countries will respond in a cyberspace. That's a big thing that has huge ramifications on jobs, markets, economy. What are some of the other things? Talk about that, but then what are some of the other big things that we need to be getting done right now?
America has become an exceptional nation because, not because of what we have taken, but because of what we have given, right? And since the end of World War II, our willingness to give a helping hand. And truly, up until that point, we have, I can make an argument that we have been isolationists more than we have been outward thinking, right? And yes, we all know what George Washington said, don't get involved and don't get intertangled with the affairs of other people. But that was a very different world back then.
Right.
The world is interconnected. And we created a international community, right? A international standards and norms that have allowed America to be the greatest nation has ever been able to see on this planet, right? What we've done with NATO and with the Marshall Plan, we had 70 years of peace and prosperity in Europe. And what did that do? That allowed us to sell and buy products with, right? Half of the world's GDP is between Europe and America, right? That's an important, that has been important to our livelihood and to our well-being. And when America uses our military might and our economic might to enforce this international order, it's good for everyone. When we retreat from that responsibility, what happens? The world gets messed up, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we're seeing what's happening in these places. So I like to boil it down to something real simple. Your enemies should fear you, and your friends should love you, right?
And not very complicated, folks.
It's complicated, right? But that also requires us to understand who our friends and enemies are.
Right.
Right. And I can make arguments all the way back to George W. Bush that administrations have gotten their enemies, thought their enemies were their friends and their friends were their enemies, right?
Saudi Arabia comes to mind, but that's I digress.
Well, look,
just me. I'm just saying.
The Obama administration thought Israel the relationship between the Obama administration and Israel was so bad.
Yeah.
It caused Israel to start working with our Sunni Arab partners,
yeah,
right? Which that's how bad it was. Like, okay,
right.
We got to solve this other thing, right? Because it's so bad with America. So foreign affairs is not foreign, right? We're in an interconnected world. And right now, part of this also, when I see what's happening in Russia, on a scale of 1 to 10, what the Russians are doing in Ukraine, I can call it a 4. Their ability to unleash hell on the Ukrainians, they still have a lot of ability to do that, right? And we, America, has the opportunity to prevent significant loss of life, right? And everybody wants to talk about escalation. This is going to escalate based on what? Based on assumptions we made back in the 80s. And it's impossible to try to predict second, third, and fourth order effects. But we can start with first principles and say, prevent the loss of life. And then we got to be prepared to deal with that. Because you know who else is watching how things are unfolding in Ukraine? The Chinese.
Chinese, yeah.
And let's also, before I get off Russia, the longer this goes on, is going to continue to have a destabilizing effect on Eastern Europe. Because you have Eastern European countries that a populace is dealing with the threat of war. You know, living in a society in which you're afraid that tomorrow there's going to be war, that has an impact on the community.
Yeah.
Two, they're dealing with the counter effects of sanctions, right? It's the closer you are to Russia, the harder the sanctions impact you. And three, the growing humanitarian crisis, potentially up to 4 million people. All of those things are going to put pressures on these governments in Eastern Europe that at one point they're going to be like, this ain't worth it. And they're going to say F Ukraine, right? And then that means Putin wins. And so the longer this draws out, this actually has destabilizing effects for the rest of us. And why is China watching this? China's watching this because they're going to figure out how to invade Taiwan,
yep,
one way or the other.
Yep.
Why does Taiwan matter? Taiwan, if China invaded Taiwan, then the Chinese government is going to own 70% of the semiconductor manufacturing in the world. Why does that matter? Because semiconductors are the building block
everything.
Of everything,
yes.
Right?
Everything.
Not just your phone, not just your smart car, not just your laptop, but your freaking refrigerator,
yep.
Right? And if you yep. think it's hard to get stuff now, it's going to be even harder there. And when you get it, the cost is going to be outrageous, right? And why would the Chinese government do this? Because they've made it very clear that they're trying to surpass the United States as the global superpower. This is not my opinion.
It's fact.
This is not me laying in bed at night pontificating on the world. This is not me being back in the CIA collecting intelligence. This is what the Chinese government has said about themselves in English, right? And so look, competition's okay. The US and China can coexist. And by the way, my beef is with the government of China. Not the Chinese people.
Right.
Definitely not Chinese Americans. The hate our Asian brothers and sisters have been seeing. It's just unreal, right? And so it's very specific. It's the Chinese government. And so I want to make sure that the US economy stays the most important economy in the world. I want to make sure that it's American culture that permeates everywhere, right? I always thought everyone was talking about the Olympics and that young lady from California,
right?
That played the skier that played for the Chinese. Look, 18-year-old girl making a decision. Okay, come on. I'm not going to get too involved in that. However, why did the president of China put the full court press on getting that 18-year-old girl to wear the Chinese, yeah. the red yeah. of the Chinese? Why? Yeah. Because Xi Jinping knows exactly what soft power and how important soft power is, right? And so these are the things that we're dealing with.
How come it seems we don't? How come it seems that our leaders not only are playing a short game, the Chinese are executing policies that they designed 100 years ago, 300 years ago. I mean, for them, it's a long game. But not only are we not playing the short game, we're not playing it well when we do. What is it that we need to be thinking about and doing here to step up our game on that stage? I mean, because you just laid out very clearly in 60 seconds the dynamic between Russia, China, with the US sort of sitting there going, I don't know, you know, do we go and give the Ukrainians bombs? And oh my God, the technology. I mean, why do we seem more inept today than we did a generation ago? Reagan could look the Russians in the eye and go, tear down this damn wall, because if you don't do it, we will, right? Mm-hmm. And yet you get to a moment with Barack Obama, and he says, all right, well, if you want Crimea, that's okay, you can have it. Mm. I don't understand what's going on.
So
a lot of Americans don't understand.
Sure. At a very basic way, it's hubris. It is people automatically assuming we're always going to be the greatest, right? That people automatically assuming that there's no way we can get kicked off of our perch. It's also an ignorance of not knowing what is the source of American power, and that how our alliances have made this important. Look, the Chinese government and the Russians, they don't have alliances. They have people that work for them, right? They don't have friends, right? And look, the amount of construction that the Chinese government has done in Africa. And part of that is to get some of the resources.
They've been doing this for decades,
right? But guess what? Most people in those countries, most Africans in the various African countries don't like the Chinese.
Don't want the Chinese there. They want to do business with Americans. And I've been telling American businesses for the last 20 years, my first foray into Africa was in 1999. And since that time, trying to network American businesses on the continent, we have the same old colonial attitude that the Europeans had is, well, it's too dangerous. It's too risky. They don't know really how to do. I mean, Africa has evolved in such a way, and the Chinese have figured it out.
Yeah.
The Pakistanis, yep. the Indians, the French, everybody else has figured it out. So you're absolutely right.
I spent my term in the CIA. My job was recruit spies, steal secrets, best job on the planet. Okay, and I started my career started in October of 2000, the day of the USS Cole bombing. That was the Navy destroyer off the coast of Yemen, in a little town called Aden, and it was done by Al Qaeda. And then my last tour, 9.5 years later, was in Afghanistan, where I ran all of our undercover operations in the country. And there was this rare earth mineral mine in Afghanistan. Some accounts it was over $2 trillion. And nobody figured out how to use that, that was a great resource for the country. You know, if Afghanistan was known more for rare earth minerals than they were for poppy, how good would that be? And guess what? We couldn't get our act together. You know what the Chinese are trying to do now?
Yeah.
Mine that rare earth mineral. Of course they
are.
Right?
Of course they are.
And so to your question is, we have forgotten the importance of this. We have forgotten how our soft power. And look, in the national security circles, we call this public diplomacy, right? And public diplomacy is carried on by more than just government officials, right? Our businesses are some of the, are those brands? How many people around the world, when you say America, they're going to say Coca-Cola, right? Because that's one of our most iconic brands. And so then when you look at some of our digital companies, right, where we're fighting with some of the big tech companies, and look, tech companies have a lot of problems, don't get me wrong, right. We can't be doing better, but we should be figuring out how that technology is used to uplift humanity, right? And guess what? The way we do it is going to be a lot better than the way the Chinese government does it, because we know what they're going to do, right? They're already putting the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in slave labor camps. They're already, why are they exporting all this technology to places like Africa and other authoritarian governments? Because they want more data. Why should we care about the national security implication of TikTok? Michael, I'm sorry. I don't care if you do some funny dance on your TikTok, okay? I don't care, right? Yeah. But all that data that is going in is training some algorithm, right? That the Chinese are going to always have more data. And when it comes to, Vladimir Putin said, whoever masters the AI is going to master the world. He said that back in 2014. And that's probably the only thing he and I agree on. AI needs a couple of things. It needs power.
Yeah.
It needs computing capacity. It needs data, and it needs algorithm. The more data you have, the better off you're going to be. That's why the Chinese government is sucking everything up. And so then you're going to have a super powerful tool that is designed by a hostile adversary And then we're going to have to learn and use those tools because those become the biggest thing. Like, I would rather have a conversation with American social media companies about what they're doing to make sure they're protecting their users than trying to have one with a Chinese company, right? And so we've just forgotten our role in the rest of the world and how that impacts us. That look, the having alliances helps us put food on our table, a roof over our head, and make sure the people we love are healthy and happy. All of these things are connected.
So as we wind down our conversation, what do you want people to walk away from when they put the book down, and they step back from it and they think about what they just read, what you just immersed them into? What's the takeaway that you want them to have? And as they then look at the rest of the world and what the challenges are ahead of us?
Great question. I want people to say, we have some very significant challenges facing our country, our society, our culture, our government, us as individuals. But we can meet those challenges the way all of our Americans, compatriots before us met those challenges. And there is a better way to achieve and to solve those big problems than the way we're trying to do that now. And that this requires all of us to play a role. This requires us to model the behavior that we want to see. This requires us to make sure that we make decisions based on our values and our principles. Like, it requires us to reward elected officials that are trying to inspire rather than fearmonger. And that there's so much we can do to ensure that this little experiment we call America continues to flourish, continues to make the quality of life better for all Americans and uplift humanity. There's a better way to do that, right? And it starts with doing something I learned when I was 17-year-old working at a computer lab in Texas A&M University. When something was wrong with that computer and I didn't know what it was doing, what'd I do? I rebooted it, right? And got it back to the original operating system. We can do that right now. And that's to allow us to get beyond the moment that we're in and make sure that we continue to uplift humanity.
I love it. Love it. See, I just threw my damn computer across the room. You're just like, no, just turn the switch and reboot the damn thing. It's not complicated.
It's not hard. It's not
I love
hard,
it. And that's the book, folks. That's the essence of the book, American Reboot. An Idealist Guide to Getting Big Things Done. The author is the one and only Will Hurd, former congressman, former CIA operative, but at the end of the day, all American, baby. We appreciate you, Will, for coming by. And it was so good to see you and hang out for just a little bit and to catch up on what you're doing. So glad you could drop by the podcast.
Always a pleasure, man. Thanks for doing what you're doing, brother.
I appreciate it. Well, that does it for this part of our conversation, folks. We really hope you enjoyed it. You got a little something out of it. Don't forget to check out Will's new book coming out on March 29th. It is called American Reboot, An Idealist Guide to Getting Big Things Done. Check it out wherever you get your books, certainly Amazon, etc. You can follow Will on Twitter. Don't forget to do that. He's a good brother. Put some good stuff up. He's at Will Hurd, real easy. And don't forget to check us out as well. You know where to find us on wherever you get your podcast, the Spreaker app for sure. If you like this episode, please comment on the Spreaker app. Let us know what you're thinking, because it helps me then understand where you guys are and I can better address your interests, and would like to do that ongoing. So until next time, folks, be safe, be well, take care of yourselves. God bless. And catch you next time. Later.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. Are you tired of the corporate-controlled media ignoring the needs of we the people? You know, the people who actually do the work? Are you tired of the platitudes that they throw at us? Remember when they called us patriotic, frontline heroes, essential, only to find out that they've lined their pockets with the fruits of our sacrifice and labor? Had enough? It's time to come together, organize, and unite. Join us at The Rick Smith Show daily by downloading the podcast each and every day. Subscribe so you never miss a minute. The Rick Smith Show podcast is found wherever you get your podcasts, from iTunes to iHeart, Stitcher to Podbean, and beyond. Go to TheRickSmithShow.com for more information on how you can get the podcast each and every day. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.